this week, an 8-year-old boy, a friend of Sir Thomas Beecham's, arrived from Italy to conduct a symphony concert at Carnegie Hall. Now, checking on child prodigies, our question this evening is, were you a junior prodigy, and did you display any exceptional talents when you were a child? That's our question.
Well, shall we go?
As the stout man said when he fell out of the patrol, I'm about to hit the road. It's good to get back to Allen's Alley, Kenny. Well, I guess the Senate has been rehearsing a speech. The hot air has warped the Venetian blinds in that front room there. Oh, well, let's knock.
Somebody put the knuckles to my wood. Oh, it's you, son.
Yes, Senator Claiborne.
Well, let's go, son. What's on your mind? I'm busier than the pea in the traffic cop's whistle when the light is changing.
You're busy?
Well, now that Eisenhower ain't going to run for president, I'm getting Harry's campaign started.
Oh, well, how?
I'm working on a song.
Oh, really? How does your campaign song go?
Let me keep my home near the Capitol Dome. It is there my affections I'll fasten. In this year, 48, oh, how I would hate to move out for Dewey or Stassen. Home, home near the dome, with Bess and Margaret and me. Well, seldom is heard a discouraging word, except from the GOP.
A little boost and you would be on the hit parade. Tell me, when you were a child, Senator, did you possess any unique talents?
Well, son, when I was 2 years old, my pappy locked me into a room.
I see.
On the floor was some oats, a whole roast beef, and a stack of money.
Yeah?
When pappy opened the door, if I was playing with the oats, he knew I'd be a farmer.
Uh-huh.
If I was eating the roast beef, I'd be a glutton.
Yeah?
If I was playing with the money, I'd be a banker.
What happened when your father came back?
I had the grain in one hand, the money in the other hand. I was sitting on the roast beef, helping myself to the gravy.
So?
Pappy knew I'd be a politician. So long, son. Come on, Eddie.
Senator still has some of that gravy on his vest, I notice. Oh, well, let's see if Mr. Moody's still up.
Howdy, Bob.
Say, Mr. Mr. Moody, you're trembling.
I'm so mad, if I was a bull, I'd snort.
What, something happened?
Well, about 6 months ago, a shopper drove up to my place in a trailer.
Yeah?
Trailer that was shaped like a big foot.
Oh, really?
He claimed he was Dr. Belrose, the Bunyan Baron.
The Bunyan Baron, eh?
Sold me 2 bottles of Belrose's Bunyan Balm.
What? What happened?
Well, sir, the first night I rubbed the Bunyan Balm on my feet...
Yes?
2 bunions come off in my hand and my big toe dissolved.
That was 6 months ago?
To the day.
I see.
Today, the same fella come around again. He's selling bird's eye swill for hogs.
You recognized him? You recognized him?
I says, I know you, Belrose, you scheming Jasper. Haul your lard off my land.
Yeah, haul his lard, eh?
He says, I'm bad news, Rube. I'll bunch you.
He'll bunch you? Well, you didn't let him get away with that.
Not your Uncle Dudley.
Yeah. Good, good.
I says, why, Belrose, you old sweat, I says, I'll knock you on your fritter.
What did he say to that?
He went whiter than a flounder's belly in the moonlight and drove off.
Tell me, Titus, did you as a child possess any unusual talents?
Why, when I was frying size, a gypsy, she read my palm.
A gypsy, huh?
Yeah, the gypsy says, this boy will grow, but when he stops growing, he won't amount to much.
Well, do you think you will ever amount to much?
I can't tell. I ain't stopped growing yet. So long, Bubba.
Let's try this next door.
Howdy, Chappie.
Mrs. Nussbaum, is that a theater program you have there?
Yes, I'm seeing from London the A La Carte Opera Company.
Oh, you mean the Doily Carte?
They are singing Gilbert and Solomon.
Which opera did you see?
The Pirates of Pincus. Little Miss Dixie, little Miss Dixie.
Say, that's very, very, very catchy.
Friends are telling me I'm singing like the Andrews sisters.
Really? The three Andrews sisters?
The fourth one. She's working in Bloomingdale.
Oh, I see.
In the basement.
Oh, fine.
In men's underwear.
Well, that's good to know.
They mention my name.
I shall if I go over.
You see, under the counter, she's hiding special union suits.
Special union suits?
In the back, they are double-breasted.
Oh. For this weather. Well, tell me, Mrs. Nussbaum, as a baby, were you exceptionally bright?
When I am a teensy-weensy, I am dancing.
As a little baby, you danced?
In the cradle, I'm funny-hugging, also trotting the turkey.
Trotting the turkey, you...
Later, on Second Avenue, by Arthur Moskowitz, up one flight, I'm taking lessons, ballet.
Oh, the ballet lessons.
This is on the toes.
Uh-huh.
I'm spinning with Shapiroette.
Shapiroette.
All day long on my toes, I'm dancing.
I see.
Today, instead of a nobody, I could be in short skirts. Outstanding.
Well, what ruined your career as a toe dancer?
A heel.
A heel?
Mine husband, Pierre.
Oh, I see. Well, that brings us to Mr. Cassidy, Sally. Let's see what Ajax is up to.
How do you do?
Well, Mr. Cassidy, how are you this evening?
Oh, terrible, terrible, terrible. I feel like Toomey the taxidermist's horse.
Really? How come?
Well, Toomey's horse had a splitting headache for 20 years.
Why couldn't he get rid of it?
Who could a horse ask for an aspirin? Only maybe another horse.
Well, that's true.
And if the other horse did give him an aspirin, how could he open one of them little boxes with them big hoofs in?
Well, what finally happened to the horse?
Well, he started to worry, and he died of an ulcer, rest his harness.
Oh, the horse died,
huh? Oh, Toomey the taxidermist wanted to stuff the horse and keep it for a little memento.
He stuffed the horse?
Toomey had to buy 30 Murphy beds and rip out the insides to fill up that horse.
Really?
He had to put in two bass drums to bulge out the hips.
Where is the horse now?
Well, Toomey has the horse in his parlor next to the piano.
Oh, really?
Yes. The horse has a glass saddle.
A glass saddle?
It's used as an ashtray.
Oh, an ashtray. Well, tell me, Mr. Cassidy, were you a child prodigy?
Me boy, I was subnormal and proud of it. All of them child prodigies come to no good end.
Well, how do you mean?
Well, now take Nipper Mulcahy. As a boy, 40 years ago, Nipper was the Irish Joel Kupperman.
Oh, really?
His hobby was figures.
Mathematics?
Oh, Nipper could add and subtract. He could do Long's division.
Long's division?
Oh, he could do algebra and logarithms and trigonometry and the like.
He was a wizard.
But figures was his downfall.
What is Nipper doing today?
7 years in the big house.
For what?
Selling numbers. Good morning.
What is your question tonight?
Well, as the old year comes to its annual close, the newspapers always chronicle the outstanding sports and news events of the departed 12 months. And so our question tonight is, what, in your estimation, was the outstanding event or happening in 1947?
Shall we go?
As the two billiard balls said when they saw the cue stick coming, let's get rolling. Here we are in Allen's Alley, Porton. Say, the senator has a Christmas wreath nailed on his door. It's an old spare tire painted green with a red ribbon on it. Well, let's knock.
Who's jiggling my latch? Oh, it's you, son.
Well, Senator Clagg.
Well, son, I've been busier than a nearsighted Mexican trying to pick up 2 pounds of jumping beans. You know, Since Stassen demanded that list of grain traders, half of Washington's gone underground.
You mean the grain?
Politicians are flocking to cooperatives.
Cooperatives?
Yeah, they don't even want to be caught with a little corn in their shoes.
Well, confidentially, Senator, did you as man to man now, did you ever speculate in grain?
Son, on my honor, hope to die, hope the cattle spit in my eye. I ain't had nothing to do with grain since I sold my wild oats.
Well, how are things around the White House, Senator?
Coming, son.
Really?
Margaret's back home, and this week somebody sent a puppy to the president. The puppy was a Democrat.
How could you tell that the little puppy was a Democrat?
He had his eyes open. I can use that joke, son. I'm writing Harry's 1948 campaign speech.
Well, I hope it goes better in the speech than it went tonight, Senator. Harry may give it something, you know. Tell me, what is the speech about?
Well, the president's going to stop people from cutting down trees.
Cutting down trees?
Yeah, he don't want the Republicans stumping the country. He don't want them stumping the country.
I had the misfortune to have heard you the first time. Tell me, what are the Republicans doing about 1948, Senator?
Well, they're calling in Ralph Edwards.
Ralph Edwards?
Yeah, he's putting on a big Republican contest.
Republican contest?
Who is Mr. Hush?
Well, confidentially, who is Mr. Hush?
Tom Dewey. So long, sir. So long, man.
Well, how do you like that? Say, in all the excitement, I forgot to ask the Senator the question. Well, I'll ask Mr. Moody, I guess.
Howdy, Bob.
Say, Mr. Moody, you sound a little hoarse.
I know. I got a cold in the head.
You too, huh? Well, how could you catch a cold in the head?
I got a run in my stocking cap. Well, before I cut the cat's tail off, I was catching cold all the time.
You were catching cold on account of the cat's tail? How come?
Well, when the winter is freezing cold...
Yes?
A short-tailed cat don't keep the door open so long coming into the house.
Well, tell me, Mr. Moody, what, in your estimation, was the outstanding event of 1947?
Why, the big wind on March 12th.
Well, how bad was the wind?
I'll tell you.
I wish you would.
My wife, Lobelia, was sitting in the yard milking.
Uh-huh.
The wind blew the cow clean out of my wife's hands.
You mean your wife?
My wife was left sitting there with her hands clenched over an empty pail.
Jesus.
Yeah, and then the wind went downtown.
Did it do any damage down there?
Why, it blew two old ladies across the street before Boy Scouts could help them. And then the wind, it went into a sporting goods store.
Uh-huh.
It so happened that there was 40 moose calls laying on the counter.
40 moose calls, huh?
Yeah. And the wind blew them 40 moose calls all to once.
Uh-huh.
It was the biggest moose call ever heard in Hoosick Falls.
The biggest moose call. Hey, well, what happened?
Why, the Elks Clubhouse jumped off its foundation and come waddling down Main Street.
How long did the wind last?
Oh, kept blowing all night.
All night?
Yeah, about midnight, it blew all the knobs off the outside doors.
Yeah?
I run out. I was fuming.
Fuming, huh?
I was in my pajamas.
Did the wind rip off your pajamas?
No, no. Just blew my top. So long, Buck.
Hi, this is too much for me. Let's see what can happen at this next door.
Howdy, Chappie.
Mrs. Nussbaum. Say, you have your overshoes on.
I'm just coming back from the movies.
Oh, the movies, eh?
Radium City Music Hall.
Radium City? What was the picture?
Good News.
Good News, huh?
It is the life of Gabriel Heater.
Fine.
And on the stage is Dancing Girls, the Ricketts.
The Ricketts? Well, Mrs. Nussbaum, what to you was the biggest thing in 1947?
Without hesitating, I'm answering the new look.
The new look, eh?
But why they are calling it the new look, this to me is altogether confusing.
You mean with those long skirts?
Where is the look? There is nothing to see.
Well, have you personally attempted the new look?
When it is first coming out, I am surprising mine husband, Pierre.
Oh, good. What was your outfit?
With a long, ravishing camel's hair ballerina skirt.
Yes.
I am wearing a raccoon peasant blouse.
Yes.
Puffing out with leg of mutton sleeves.
I see.
Over black seamless nylons.
Yes.
Is peeking out rhinestone pantalette.
Peeking out.
With cinnamon-colored gaiters.
Gosh.
With this, I am wearing open-toed moccasins.
Yes.
And overall, a baggy weasel cape.
Yes.
Caught at the neck with a Tootsie Roll. The 10-cent size.
The 10-cent size. Say.
And for a staff, I am carrying a buffalo leg.
A buffalo leg. What happened?
When I am coming home, I am saying, surprise, it is the new look.
Well, what did your husband say?
Pierre also was saying, new look.
New look?
New look for another husband.
What is your question tonight?
Well, one of the greatest problems facing the country today, of course, is housing. Here in New York City, thousands of people are looking for places to live. And so our question is, how is the housing shortage affecting you?
Shall we go?
As one B-29 said to the other, let's take off. Ah, Portland, it sure is good to be back down here in Allen's Alley.
I wonder if the same people still live here.
Well, there's only one way to find out. I'll knock at this first door again.
Somebody, I say somebody knocked. Who was it?
Pardon me, mister.
Senator Claghorn's the name. Claghorn, that is.
Senator Claghorn?
I'm from the South, the Deep South.
From way down south.
Eh? Yeah, I'm so far down south that my family's treading water in the Gulf Stream.
Hey, that is south, isn't it?
Yeah, where I live, we call the people from Alabama Yankees.
Well, I don't know.
Don't butt in when a body's talking, son. Try listening. Say, try listening. You're bound to learn something.
Well, look, Senator.
Anything gets me down, it's two people trying to talk at the same time.
Well, I know,
Bill. I got the floor, son. Don't try no filibuster.
Now, look, Senator. What about the housing shortage down there in Washington?
I stop at a hotel.
Oh, you actually have a room?
What room?
You mean,
For $20 a day, they give me a chair in the lobby and a sleeping pill. Pill, that is.
What is the housing problem coming to, Senator?
There's only one solution.
And that is?
Close up the OPA.
Well, what will happen if we close the OPA?
There'll be millions of ceilings left over.
Yes?
You put four walls under them ceilings, you got houses. So long, son. So long, that is.
You know, I think the senator's got something there. Got something there. I wonder what a knock at this next door will bring.
Howdy, Bob.
Oh. You're,
Titus Moody's my name.
Titus Moody?
Moody by name, Moody by nature.
Well, tell me, Mr. Moody, has the housing shortage bothered you any?
Yeah. That's why I had to leave the farm, Bob.
Really?
Yeah. The land was so poor, you'd have to use 20 sacks of fertilizer to raise a tune on it.
Gosh.
Cows were so weak, they used to travel in pairs.
The cows had to travel in pairs?
Yeah. Took two cows to pull up a blade of grass.
The land was dry, was it?
Dry? I didn't see no water for 20 years.
20 years.
One day it rained.
Yes.
When the first drop of water hit me, I fainted.
Yes.
Yeah, they had to throw two buckets of dust in my face to bring me to.
Gosh, how did you cope with the housing problem, Titus?
Why, I ordered one of them two-room houses from Sears Roebuck. but it didn't help.
You mean when Sears Roebuck delivered the two rooms?
Sears
room house?
Sears was living in the front room, and Roebuck was living in the back. Go on, Buck.
Well, if I... If farmers can't find houses, I guess traveling salesmen will just have to keep on traveling. And that brings us to another door.
No.
Oh, Mrs. Nussbaum.
You were expecting maybe Emperor Shapiro Hito?
Tell me, Mrs. Nussbaum, how do you feel about the housing shortage?
Thanks to the housing shortage, today Pansy Nussbaum is enjoying connubial bliss, if you'll pardon the expression.
Yes. Well, what happened? What happened, Mrs. Ann?
Is flocking to mine house relatives.
Relatives?
Blood relatives. Relatives without blood.
Say, you must have a full house.
Full. And the couch is sleeping two Rappaports, cousins.
Uh-huh.
And the dining room table is sleeping four Weinsteins.
All four of them on one table?
They are half-brothers. It is making only two.
Oh, well. I see.
In the bathtub is sleeping Ben Schwartz, an uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And top Uncle Ben is the little thinker's boy. He is floating on the water.
Oh. The pinker's boy is a good swimmer?
A human sturgeon.
Oh, really? Well, tell me, Mrs. Nussbaum, with all your relatives jamming the house, didn't your husband get mad?
Mad? One morning, Pierre is putting on his beret. He is taking his Molly Pecan records.
Took his Pecan records with him, huh?
And he is stamping out.
Your husband left you?
For 2 weeks, I am a widow.
Well, what happened?
One night, is coming on the door, I'm knocking. Pit-a-pat, pit-a-pat.
Pit-a-pat. Your husband?
Mine, Pierre, is back.
Oh, it was true love. Pierre couldn't live without you.
Love, schmuck. Pierre couldn't find a room.
Well, here we are near the end of the alley. I wonder who lives here.
Hello, hello. We're here to say hello. Not howdy-do, not polly-boo, but just hello.
Now, wait a minute, wait a minute, look. But just a minute. Who are you boys?
We're McGee and McGee. We're songwriters.
What songs have you written?
Have you heard? We're looking for the guy that began the beginning to see if we can get him to stop it.
No.
Have you heard? When my baby smiled at me, I wish she'd put in her teeth.
No.
We got a patriotic song.
What is your patriotic song called?
Good luck, Mr. Truman. You're a real red, white, and blooming.
Now, look, please. Tonight, it so happens we're discussing the housing shortage.
We just wrote a housing shortage song.
A housing song? How does it go?
Hit it, Sam. The situation's serious. It may get worse by spring. We need a housing shortage, and that is why we sing. East side, west side, all around Broadway. You can't find a place to live, no matter what you pay. Hotels and apartments are crowded everywhere you walk. If it gets any worse, we'll all be sleeping on the sidewalks of New York.
What is your question tonight?
Was your family income higher in 1944? And if it was, what accounted for the increase?
Shall we go?
As the nostril said to the Kleenex, I think I'll blow. Something tells me the Senate is home. I smell chitlings cooking.
Somebody has to say somebody now.
Yes, I know.
Claghorn's the name. Senator Claghorn, that is.
You don't have to.
I'm from the South. The only candy I eat is cotton candy.
I don't care what
you... Seen Gone with the Wind 72 times.
Look, I don't
when
care...
When I'm in New York, I refuse to drive through the Lincoln Tunnel.
Now, look, Senator.
Now, what's eating your son out with
well,
it?
Well, I just would
your
like...
Your jaw keeps wagging, but nothing comes out.
Well, I don't get
you're
it.
You're like Charlie McCarthy without Edgar Bergen.
Well, if you just give me a chance...
Regular dummy. Dummy, that is.
Now, wait a minute. I... Put me down off your knee, Senator. Now, what about families earning more money in 1944?
Well, it ain't what people earn, son. It's what they can keep.
You mean?
Most people end up with nothing.
It's the law of averages?
It's the Ways and Means Committee.
The Ways and Means?
If you've got means, they'll find ways to get it. So long, son. So long, that is.
So long, Senator.
Don't forget, vote for Jefferson Davis.
I'll write him in. Well, you can tell the senator's doing a whale of a job. Instead of a cane, he carries a harpoon. Oh, well, let's see if Titus Moody is here.
Howdy, Bob.
Well, you don't look so well tonight, Mr. Moody.
No.
Oh, you have sinus trouble?
Yeah. When I was a little boy, my mother used to pick me up with the nose.
Your mother picked you up by the nose?
I had small ears.
Oh, I... Well, I couldn't see your ears. You have your ear laps on there.
Yeah, I've been out chasing my wife.
Chasing your wife, huh?
My wife had a dog biscuit, accidental.
Ate a dog biscuit?
Yeah, last two nights.
Uh-huh.
She's been running up and down the road barking at strangers.
Well, about these higher wages, how did you do in 1944?
Only made one deal.
One deal, huh?
Yeah, in January, I bought a pig for $8.
I see.
Fed the pig $12 worth of swill.
Yeah.
$20 worth of mash.
Yeah.
December, I sold the pig for $40.
Now, wait a minute. If you bought the pig for $8, spent $12 for swill, that's $20. $20 more for mash, that's $40. And you say you sold the pig for only $40.
Yeah, I didn't make no money.
No?
No, but I had the use of the pig all the year. So long, Bob.
Well, Mr. Moody will never know enough to bring home the bacon, I guess. Let's see what happens at this next door.
No.
Oh, Mrs. Nussbaum.
You are expecting maybe Rathu and Yossel.
Tell me, Mrs. N., did your family make more money in 1944?
Money is all over.
Oh, really?
In the closets is money.
Closets?
And the shelf is money. The cat, a little pussy, is sleeping on money.
Well, were you, with all this money, were you and Pierre both working?
I am welding with overtime.
Oh, welding, huh?
Pierre is working in the shipyard.
Fine.
He is a funnel sealer.
A funnel sealer?
Yes. When a ship is finished,
uh-huh.
Pierre is sealing up the funnel.
Well, why should he seal up the funnel?
If nothing is in the funnel,
yeah.
Smoke can go up.
Oh, I see. Well, what happened to all this money you made?
Pierre is buying a filling station.
Good, a filling station.
Pierre's gasoline heaven.
Gasoline?
Open 23 hours a day.
23 hours? Why not 24?
A man has to sleep.
Oh. Pierre ran the whole station alone?
And what service he is giving.
You mean when a car drove up?
Pierre is running out and combing the raccoon tail on the radiator cap. Next, with a squidgy, he is cleaning the windshield.
Good.
He is waxing the chassis,
uh-huh.
Putting air in the tires.
Good.
Polishing the fenders.
I see.
And for the driver, he is shining the shoes, pressing the suit, and blacking the hat.
Say, with that service, Pierre must have made a fortune.
In 2 months, he is broke.
Broke?
Pierre is so busy combing, cleaning, waxing, shining, and pressing.
Yes?
He is forgetting to sell gasoline.
And today?
He is still calling it Pierre's Gasoline Heaven.
Uh-huh.
But the business is going to...
I see your point.
Thank you.
Today, the real humorist is fast disappearing. Yes, sir, the average radio comedian is a mouth that speaks the thoughts of others' brains. Machine-age humor, like the automobile, is turned out on the assembly line.
Living 1949. Brought to you each week at this time by NBC and its affiliated stations, convinced that a sense of humor is essential to making sense of our times, holds up its radio mirror today to reflect...
the state of American humor.
And here with the customary smile on his face, a little broader than usual, is Ben Grauer.
Greetings, America. It was Carlyle, our researchers tell us, who once said... how much lies in laughter... the cipher key wherewith we decipher the whole man.
Yes, and Carlyle might well have added the cipher key, too, to unraveling the character of whole generations. What men laugh at and why? Someday someone will reflect the history of mankind through these. For each generation makes its own humor, and by its humor as well as by its bones and its battles shall we know it. And so in the midst of living 1949, we examine the state of the nation... by examining the state of American humor. To this end, we've sought to tickle our curiosity with the following questions.
What exactly is humor? For instance, what makes people laugh? Does humor have a history?
What does humor do for us?
How would you rate our humor today? And what about humor tomorrow?
Questions are easily come by. Digging up the answers isn't so easy, so we had to dig up an authority. You can put away the shovel, boys. Here he is, Fred Allen.
Well, thank you, Ben Grauer, and good afternoon, students of laughter. Gosh, I wish this was night school, Ben. This is a little too early in the day for me to scintillate. Am I using the right word?
Very scintillate? Good, Fred.
You approve of it. I only have it on approval for the afternoon. You know, comedians and night watchmen do their best work after the sun goes down. But since Brother Grauer has opened the forum, I shall do my best, naturally, to carry on. May I have the first question, please?
Oh, well, Mr. Allen, what exactly is humor? For instance, what makes people laugh?
Oh, an excellent question. What makes people laugh? So many times my sponsor has asked that question. Down through the ages, there have been many answers to that question. What makes people laugh? Sigmund Freud once said...
strictly speaking, we do not know what we are laughing about.
Say, Freud not only has a dialect, he seems to be a trifle confused along with it. Well, let's try one of the most amusing Americans that ever lived, Mark Twain.
The secret source of humor itself is not joy, but sorrow.
Mark's a little indefinite, too. Now, let's see. Before I was born, surely someone must have analyzed humor.
Easy does it, sonny.
Ah, and you, sir, you are...
Josh Billings, my friend. I was telling the jokes when they was really new on Living 1849.
Ah, yes, Mr. Billings. You're one of the foremost characters in American humor. Can you help us with our question? What exactly is humor?
Why, humor is wit with a rooster's tail feather stuck in its cap. It produces laughter, which, anatomically speaking, is the sensation of feeling good all over and showing it principally in one spot.
Well, thank you, Josh Billings. That answers the $64 question. Stand by for Gabriel and the giant jackpot. And so there you have it, America. Humor is that factor in man's makeup that produces laughter and makes him feel good all over. Of course, there is no set rule as to what makes your lips turn up at the corners. That, of course, depends on what you have between your ears. But the unexpected in any situation, the incongruous, that is the basis of humor. Now, let me see. There was another part to the question.
Yes, Mr. Allen. What does humor do for us?
Oh, yes, yes, of course. What does humor do for us? And for the answer to that one, we begin where most people usually end, with this gentleman here, bearing the couch and the goatee, the psychiatrist.
People laugh to protect themselves by pretending to take lightly those things which affect them most seriously.
I see. Well, there is more truth in that, America, than psychology. Indeed, as our recent acquaintance, Josh Billings, once said...
If a man can't laugh, there's some mistake made in putting them together. And if he won't laugh, he wants as much keeping away from as a bear trap when it's set.
Well, this, according to Josh, is what humor does for us. It's a relief, a safety valve. It gets things out of our systems. And why should I bother to dig up Josh Billings just to argue about that? Which brings us to our third question.
Mr. Allen, does humor, like more respectable subjects, have a history?
There will be a brief pause here, not for station identification, but while I resent the implication that my business is not respectable. Now, as for the question I hasten to answer, Dame Humor has a past. That's possibly why she's referred to as a dame. I can close my eyes now and hear the first joke that was ever cracked. The scene, somewhere around a few eons after the Ice Age. I see the forest primeval, prehistoric animals looking like refugees from some museum with their flesh on. And finally, I see a caveman, possibly an ancestor of Jack Benny's. He's carrying the jawbone of a relative. He's meeting along one of nature's byways a second caveman. Says the first caveman to the second caveman,
Say... Who that lady I see you with last night?
Answers the second caveman.
That was no lady. That was wife.
Whether or not this is truly the Adam Eve of all jokes has been subject to some dispute in the more learned circles which I seldom frequent. Personally, I can think of no other joke that could have preceded it. But once man got the idea, once he saw how laughter made him feel good all over, like breathing, he made a habit of it, and he never afterwards gave it up. By the time the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth, men and women through bitter experience had learned to laugh at almost anything. The wit of the New England Yankee is chiseled imperishably in stone, in gravestone.
Beneath this silent stone is laid a noisy, antiquated maid, who from her cradle talked till death, and ne'er before was out of breath.
It was Ben Franklin, in between tying keys to kite strings, who brought this kind of humor to its zenith. Franklin invented the first American fool character. Poor Richard with his almanac. And out of the mouth of this babe in the history of American humor came such bone-dry comments as...
Keep your eyes wide open before marriage and half shut afterwards.
Thus off to a happy start, Americans went right on laughing into the 1800s. And like the people, the humor became independent, assertive, attacking pretensions both high and low. But when the nation began to grow and stretch its muscles westward, with the blossoming of new cities, blossomed a new humor, the humor of the frontiersman, boundless like the nation itself.
Yes, sir, it's a tall country. Why, in California, the fogs are so thick, the ships often sail right across them till they hit the Sierra Nevada mountains. Why, they even nail shingles to the fog, and it gets so cold at night... Your shadow freezes on the wall, and they have to use blow torches to thaw it out.
You see, blow torches. Today, smudge pots. A gag then, it's a gag now. California weather. So taking Davy Crockett and Paul Bunyan in stride, and with Paul it's quite a stride, by 1850, American humor was out of the woods and into the minstrel halls.
Listen,
yeah. Yeah?
Can you tell me which is fastest, heat or cold?
No, Julius. Which is the fastest?
Why, heat.
Heat? How so?
Because anybody can catch cold.
It was a leisurely age of leisurely humor, uncorrupted by Hooper ratings. And one which, if the good Lord had consulted me, I certainly would have been very happy to match wits in. Besides our late friend Josh Billings, One of the prime favorites of those days was Charles Brown, better known as Artemus Ward. Artemus once remarked,
"Most of the girls in Utah marry young. Brigham Young."
Of Ward and Billings, Abe Lincoln once confessed,
"For the genius to write these things, I would gladly give up my office."
Say, you know, that reminds me, I have yet to hear Truman, Harry S., say that about me. But let's not be wistful. Comes now Mark Twain. Mark Twain, who said he never saw his father smile, was truly a giant in American humor. With the kind of time on his hands that I have never known since I discovered radio, Mark casually spun his fun, much of which, thank heaven, is not suitable for radio. Mark marked a shift in American humor from the fool way of saying things to the wise way, and he it was who glorified a great American characteristic, the ability to poke fun at ourselves. Twain was a natural. He didn't work at being funny. He just naturally was funny. With progress, laugh here, folks. The leisure of the times that marked the humor of Twain went down the drain. By the turn of the century, we're entering the 20th century, just in case you've become lost as we've come along the way, the big city industrialized populace turned to the faster-moving humor of my late habitat, vaudeville.
Say, Joe, how can you stop a dead fish from smelling?
I don't know, Harry. How can you keep a dead fish from smelling?
Cut off its nose!
Like life, the pace of humor was stepped up. Everybody began to work at being funny, and the long, dragged-out humorous story shrunk to the short, snappy gag. The First World War came and went, leaving a backwash of so-called college humor, very vaudeville. Throughout these post-war years, new names came to the fore.
W.C. Fields, Rube Goldberg, Irvin S. Cobb, Bugs Baer, to name a few. And Ogden Nash, whose verse typified a smart-aleck quality of the era.
Many an infant that screams like a calliope could be soothed by a little attention to his diapy.
Actors, cartoonists, writers of nonsense for nonsense' sake. But the man who truly commanded the grins of the nation, strangely enough using the old ways, was a drawling, gum-chewing guy from Claremore, Oklahoma.
Americans are getting just like Ford cars. They have all the same parts, the same upholstery, and make exactly the same noises.
Will Rogers. Will Rogers, who when introduced at the White House to...
Mr. Coolidge, may I present Will Rogers?
Pardon me, Al. Didn't get your name.
When Will met his unfortunate death, the golden age of the jester had just arrived. The talking picture was here to stay, and radio. Radio with the unseen, with the audience removed from the sight, identifying its unseen comedians with...
You nasty man!
Amos as regusted.
Was you there, Charlie?
And so we reach the present, characterized in the words of Donald Ogden Stewart.
The age of newer nonsense, larger lunacy, higher goofyism, and humor gone nuts.
Well, Ben, I guess that about does it. I left out one line. I'll go back and read it if you want to.
Wasn't that about Will Rogers?
He said, the President of the United States, and then Will should have spoken. But Will was in a hurry to get away again.
Well, Fred, we really thank you for presiding at the peephole while we rattle the skeletons in the closet of American humor. But tell us, Fred, now that you've brought us up to modern times, what about the answer to our next question, namely...
Mr. Allen, how would you rate our humor today? What does it reveal about us?
Well, go ahead, my guard's down. Why don't you interview me?
Oh, no, you're the narrator on today's program.
But I'm also the authority, don't forget, Ben.
Well, I guess there's only one way out, then. On the subject of present-day humor...
Yes?
Fred Allen interviews Fred Allen.
Well, I guess this proves it. If you stay in radio long enough, you'll end up talking to yourself.
Tell me, Mr. Allen.
Yes, Fred.
How would you characterize the humor of today?
The humor of today is like the times. Mechanized, urbanized, produced in such quantity, it's downright chaotic.
Uh-huh. But why is that, Mr. Allen?
Well, look at the various demands put upon humor today. Humor for magazines, books, movies, plays, newspapers, radio.
Did you say radio, Mr. Allen?
Radio? Yes, I did say radio, sir. Radio is exactly where humor has reached its lowest ebb.
My word. And you would say, Mr. Allen?
I would say that while so-called radio humor flows unceasingly, it has lost all spontaneity. The king of the airwaves, the comedian, is rarely more than a mouthpiece for his writers. Now, witness one Jack Benny, who once confronted me with, "You wouldn't talk to me like that if I had my gag writers here."
You don't say.
Yes, I did say. But it didn't sound like Benny, but I did say. Yes, too many comedians... too many comedians survive on the brains of other people.
Is that bad, Mr. Allen?
Bad, Fred? Don't you ever listen to the radio?
But whose fault is it, Mr. Allen?
Well, it's nobody's fault. Radio comedians are victims of the times. Radio as a medium demands more so-called humorous material than there are creative minds to supply it.
Tell me, is it a hard life, Mr. Allen?
Is it a hard life? Is it a hard life? Have you ever thought what a radio comedian goes through in a week?
Monday,
from the moment my alarm clock rings, I begin to hear those inner voices.
You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be funny on Sunday.
I pull the covers up over my head. I stuff my fingers into my ears. But it's no use. The voices are always there, haunting me.
You gotta be funny on Sunday.
I jump out of bed. I flex my legs. I begin another week on the treadmill of radio.
Tuesday.
By Tuesday, I'm starting to get nervous. I reassure myself and sneak a peek at a fan letter about my last program. The fan letter reads,
"Do you smell?"
And back come the voices.
You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be funny on Sunday.
I haul out the jokes I've been stuffing into my pockets. Notes for jokes written on subways, in movies, on lonely walks, in the midst of nightmares. I take one horrible look and send for my usual breakfast. Say, Portland, poach two aspirin on toast.
Wednesday.
Wednesday again, and those voices greet me.
You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be funny on Sunday.
But I defy them, because Wednesday is when I meet with my writers. My writers will save me. I know they'll save me.
Well, morning, Mr. Allen.
Morning, Mr. Allen.
Morning, Mr. Allen.
Well, boys, we need plenty of jokes for Sunday.
I got one, Mr. Allen.
Yes, Bob.
How's this? Listen, who was that ladle I saw you with last night? That was no ladle. That was my wife.
Hey, that's pretty good. I like that very much. I like that very much.
Yes. Here we are back with the cavemen. With these radio writers, I must seek to replace the ledger of Mark Twain. Louder grow the voices.
You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be funny on Sunday.
No, 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 no. Thursday, we've got one joke. We need 75 more jokes to fill the script. Once again, I turn hopefully when one of my writers says...
Then you meet a guy on the street, see?
Yeah, yeah.
And he says to you, "Have you seen my dog?"
My dog.
And you say, "You mean the dog that limps with the black hair, long floppy ears, leather collar, and the spot between his eyes?" He says, "Yes." And you say, "No, I haven't seen him."
Wait a minute, Sam. Look, I can't tell that gag. That gag goes back to Voltaire.
Who's Voltaire? I stole that one from Bob Hope.
Friday,
we really get into mass production humor. After the first rehearsal, the cry goes up for gags. Gags. We need more gags, men. Gags about...
babies, barbers, beauty, boats,
drips, droops, dopes, dames.
To add to this bedlam, there are always those voices.
You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be funny on Sunday. You gotta be funny.
Saturday.
Saturday is baked beans, more rehearsal and cutting, and of course...
You gotta be funny on Sunday.
I know. I'm ready.
Ladies and gentlemen, we give you the funniest man in America, Fred Allen!
Thank you, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight, I start my program with a little song entitled, When They Find Out About Phenobarbital in Tennessee, It'll Be Sleepy Time Down South.
Well, I guess the business of being funny today just ain't funny, Fred.
Well, that's just about it, Brother Grauer. Radio humor has become a serious mass-produced enterprise, demanding material to fill 18 hours a day, and in the process leaving its exhausted perpetrators, writers and actors both, mark you, with naught but blank expressions and trembling hands.
Fred, you've told us what humor is. Things are tough all over. You've told us what humor is, what
all
it does
me.
For us, something of its history, how you rate it today, and what it reveals about us. That is, how it reflects the fast tempo of modern life.
Yes.
Now, what about the future, Fred? You think, will things get any better? For instance,
will we laugh more tomorrow?
Well, the only way I can answer that question is to ask another question. Will we slow down tomorrow? Now, all humor, in my opinion, should be created and disseminated in an atmosphere of relaxation. There should be time to think humor, time to tell humor, and to enjoy humor. Maybe with men working fewer hours in the day and finding more leisure, the quality of our humor will improve. But I have my doubts. And certainly radio works against all of this.
Well, you see little hope then for humor in radio.
Well, where there's life, of course, there's always hope, Ben. But the present-day trend, to me, it seems to be in the wrong direction. Now, look, I never thought that I would live to see the day when I'd have to compete with a washing machine and $300,000. Iceboxes are replacing actors and musicians. The idea is, of course, if you can't entertain people, give them something. Now, if that isn't a sorry commentary on contemporary entertainment, then I don't know a sorry commentary when I see one. And I have seen some sorry commentaries. I'm an authority on sorry commentaries, as a matter of fact.
Fred, but look, there's a new thought about what about television?
Well, television, I'm afraid, is going to make it worse, Ben. In the beginning, as you know, television drove people out of the saloons into their homes. But now people have sets in their homes. Television is driving them out of their homes back into the saloons.
Oh, no, wait a minute. But as a new source of humor,
oh,
Fred?
Oh, new source of humor. So far, it's nothing but a throwback, reviving the vaudeville approach to everything, from mugging to juggling. But who can tell, Ben? Television is doing such great things in drama. Who knows? It may find the answer to what is lacking in American humor today.
Well, that brings us, Fred, to the last question of all. So what?
So what? Well, if you've summed up, so shall I. We can take hope from the fact that regardless of what radio and television are doing to it, humor will never die. Yes, maybe if we can find a common bond in humor to stop the fussing, fighting, and feuding in the world, we might actually laugh our way into peace. In the final analysis, laughter is the universal language of mankind, and a little nonsense now and then is relished by the wisest men.
A thousand thanks, Fred Allen. Living 1949 is prepared and presented for the University of the Air by an NBC special program staff under the supervision of Wade Arnold. Lou Haslam writes the scripts. Music is conducted by Milton Kadams. This program is directed by Jack Cuney. Next week, a drama document on the Marshall Plan, Operation Cooperation.
Robert Montgomery stars in Mr. and Mrs. Smith tonight on NBC.
It is customary, I know, for a speaker to make a few flattering remarks about the guest of honor. I know him from the performer's side for many years. I first met Mr. Benny many years ago in vaudeville. I was playing Centralia, Illinois, the big house. And Mr. Benny was appearing at a small theater in a suburb of Centralia. The theater was so far back in the woods, the manager was a bear. He used to pay the axe off in honey. It's the only one. And the theater really wasn't a building. It was a cave. And Mr. Benny's dressing room was a hollow tree. Variety didn't cover this theater. The acts were reviewed by the dramatic critic of Forest and Stream. Mr. Benny was closing, was next to closing on a two-act bill. The feature act was a fire eater. You know, in those days, there was no heat in the theaters, and managers used to book fire eaters. Before the show, the manager would chase the fire eater up and down the aisles. The fire eater would start breathing hard and heat up the theater. Well, this fire eater on the bill with Mr. Benny was a worrier. The first fire eater I ever knew who had an ulcer. It was a pilot light. Well, Mr. Benny's act, as I recall, in those days, was rather unique. He worked as a gypsy. And after the show, he would sit in the lobby with his gypsy robes on and tell fortunes. As the act opened, the stage was dark, and Mr. Benny would come on playing glowworm on his violin with a neon bow. During his rendition, Mr. Benny hit so many clinkers that he had to stoke his violin after each number. Mr. Benny was the only violinist. After you heard him play, you felt that the strings would sound better if they were back in the cat. For the finish of his act, Mr. Benny played Stars and Stripes Forever and waved an American flag. After his first bow, he also waved a Union Jack, in case there was an Englishman in the audience. In those days, Mr. Benny had no suitcase. When he left town, he would take the strings off his violin and use them to tie up his wardrobe. Well, after this first meeting in vaudeville, since I only played the bigger cities, I didn't see Mr. Benny again for many years. Our paths crossed next during World War I. Mr. Benny was wearing a sailor suit. We, of course, all know his record in the Navy. Mr. Benny was the first sailor in the history of the Navy to ever get seasick in a recruiting office. Even today in the Friars Club, Mr. Benny has to take Dramamine before he can look at the Yacht Club boys. When Sailor Jack finally got on his first battleship, he thought every deck was the poop deck. They were giving it to him all over the boat. But after the war, Mr. Benny had some lean years. He used to lean against the front of the palace and wonder if he would ever get inside. Things got so bad when he practiced his violin, he was using his dandruff for rosin. For a time, he left show business and took a job in a health food store. He had an acid condition. He used to stand near the milk and make yogurt out of the milk by appointment. Then his luck... I may as well get a few laughs here. I get none in television. Of course, you know about it. Then his luck changed. Mr. Benny married, and his wife was so clever, he was able to get back into show business. He appeared in Earl Carroll's Vanities. In one memorable tableau, Mr. Benny came on the stage dressed as Abraham Lincoln. For many years, Lincoln had been on the penny, but thanks to Mr. Benny's impersonation, the scent was finally on Lincoln. Well, Mr. Benny's record speaks for itself. He was in vaudeville until 1930 when vaudeville died. He appeared in Broadway shows and the theater declined. He went into motion pictures and the industry collapsed. He has been in radio and radio is slowly disintegrating. This summer he went to Korea and instantly the Communist Army agreed to discuss peace terms. After killing vaudeville, ruining the theater, causing the decline of the motion picture and radio, Mr. Benny has at last gone into television. Television may as well pucker its screen, for it is about to receive the kiss of death. But I have only been joking in a mild way, ladies and gentlemen. Jack is, as I know and we all know, the best-liked man in show business today. And if our country was only fortunate enough to enjoy the status Jack enjoys, our country, too, would not have an enemy in the world. On this note, I close, ladies and gentlemen. There is only one friar living who would travel 3,000 miles across the country to get a free meal, and he is your guest of honor tonight.